Once again, this is Richard Clem. We're in Rochester, Minnesota today. We're going to be talking about early Minnesota legal history. And I will be doing a video replay of this course, and also at some point I will have it on the internet for Wisconsin credit as a podcast. And for purposes of that, during the course of the program, I will be saying three code words that the podcast listeners will have to report to confirm their attendance. Those of you here live and in person, you don't have to worry about the code words, and there will be no test at the end of today's program. Well, again, today we're going to be talking about early Minnesota legal history, mostly from the territorial days and the early days of Minnesota statehood, so the 1840s and 1850s. And you might ask, well, why would we do a CLE on this subject? Well, there's three reasons, really. One, first of all, you will get CLE credit for it, and that's always a good reason for attending a CLE. Some CLEs are interesting, some are useful, and I think you'll find that this is definitely one of the interesting ones. It's kind of interesting, some of the stuff that came up back then. But also, surprisingly enough, some of it will actually prove useful in your practice. Not in your day-to-day practice, probably. It's very unlikely that you will get anything out of this course that you will use in a case that you have pending Monday morning. But it will give you kind of a historical background, first of all, to some of the things that some of the things in Minnesota law. And some of it is actually still relevant, not necessarily to a great extent. But when you deal with the Minnesota Constitution in any way, there will be situations where you have to construe that. And having some of this historical background can prove helpful in the construction of the state constitution. And in some cases, most notably the right to trial by jury, some of these territorial cases that we talk about are actually kind of locked in to Minnesota law by virtue of the adoption of the Constitution. So again, it will not be the kind of stuff that that will prove immediately useful, but I think that occasionally, in the midst of some case, you might get something from today that that will prove somewhat useful. If you do have any questions during the program, feel free to ask, or we'll have time at the end of the program for questions. I will kind of anticipate one of those questions, and that question is, well, what about the Native Americans? You didn't say anything about them. And that is true, and I think that's kind of a fair criticism. But what we're going to be talking about today is the history of the law as it formed in the territorial days and days of early statehood. And for better or worse, the law is the creation of people like legislators and judges. And during this time period, typically those were the white men from back east who came here. They were, without exception, I think white. Without exception, I think male. And the vast majority of them came from the eastern states and settled out here. So when we talk about the history of the law that they created, by necessity, we're going to be talking about them and not necessarily other people, such as the Native Americans. But one thing to keep in mind, though, is the great importance that the Native Americans played in the early development of the Minnesota Territory. Because we'll be talking a little bit about many things, among others, the fur trade. And the fur trade was really the first economic activity that took place in this part of the country. And it's really what gave rise to there being enough settlers here for it to become a territory and later a state. And how the fur trade worked was typically fur traders from back east would bring trinkets and trade goods, not necessarily just trinkets, many of them, you know, useful items, pots and pans and rifles and blankets. And they would trade those with the Native Americans for furs that the Native Americans had captured. So the white men from east who were involved in the fur trade were not really involved in going out and catching the beavers to turn them into furs. That economic work, which really created the territory in the state, was the work of the Native Americans. So that should be kept in mind. But other than that, like I say, because the law is the creation of white men from the East, probably very little will be said about the Native Americans. Well, I entitled the first section of the written materials, Minnesota Under Four Flags. And that's talking about the four national flags that flew over this country back in the day. Originally Spain, I don't think there were too many Spaniards running around up here, but it was Spain on the map anyway. Later France, the mostly west of the Mississippi, and then east of the Mississippi, Britain, and later the United States. And I don't have a map with me, but if you can visualize a map, the main geographic feature that we'll be talking about is the Mississippi River. And Minnesota, like Louisiana, is a state that's kind of bisected by the Mississippi. And the history, that's kind of the key dividing line, because the portion of Minnesota west of the Mississippi was originally part of French Louisiana, later on the Louisiana Territory of the United States, and then that was later divided up into states, starting with Louisiana and kind of concluding with Iowa and Minnesota. The portion east of the Mississippi was generally in British territory prior to independence, and then after independence, that became American territory. So that's kind of the main bisector. The one exception to that is a little piece way up in the northwestern part of Minnesota. That was originally part of Rupert's Land, which was originally owned by the Hudson's Bay Company, and then later, kind of concurrently with the British Crown. So that was British territory. And that came into the United States in 1818. So that's kind of more just a trivia item up there. Other than that piece, the main way to divide Minnesota is by the Mississippi River. And as we'll see later on, the portion that was part of Wisconsin really is kind of a more significant in the laws. But the history of Minnesota law really has to begin with the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, and that is really one of the most important acts of Congress ever, and certainly the most important statute passed by the Continental Congress, because to a certain extent that still has some legal effect that continued over the years, but that was actually an act that predated the Constitution. It was passed by the Continental Congress in 1787. And what the Northwest Ordinance was prior to 1787, the various states had laid claims to the northwestern United States, the country west of the Ohio River. And some of those were conflicting claims. I think, for example, where we're standing today, I think, not positive, but I think we were claimed by Virginia, where we are here today in Rochester. The Ordinance of 1787, the first thing it did was the individual states ceded their claims to that western territory west of their state boundaries to the national government. As of that date, we were no longer part of Virginia or whatever state might have laid claim to us. And in addition, that Northwest Ordinance was what's called the Organic Act. You'll hear the term Organic Act a few times today. An Organic Act is a statute that creates a new kind of entity, such as the Northwest Territory. So as of that time, the country west of the Ohio River became Northwest Territory. And the Northwest Territory is kind of like the same status that, you know, Puerto Rico or the Virgin Islands would have today. It's a territory, it was a territory of the United States. So it had a territorial legislature, it had territorial judges, it had a territorial Supreme Court. That continued until Ohio became a state. And then as every state joined the Union, starting with Ohio, the remaining territory was chopped off into and formed into a new territory. But the other important thing about the Northwest Ordinance was that it really kind of served as the first constitution governing this area, because it contained a certain kind of a Bill of Rights. It contained statements, first of all, that there shall never be slavery in this territory, because obviously in 1787 slavery was still a major issue. So first of all, it declared that there would not be slavery or involuntary servitude anywhere within this new Northwest Territory. And it also contained a Bill of Rights expressing other rights. And in many cases, it purports to act in perpetuity. So, for example, talking about it says, the inhabitants of said territory shall always be entitled to the benefits of the writs of habeas corpus and trial by jury. Well, we here in Minnesota, we're inhabitants of that said territory. So, I mean, an argument can be made that that Bill of Rights that was enacted then, which purports to act in perpetuity, is still valid. Now, I would not just walk into court and make that as your only argument. You say, Judge, I have this 1787 law. This is going to crack the case wide open. You have to rule in our favor. If you say that, you'll probably lose. The arguments we're going to be talking about today, like I said, they will be somewhat useful. But you have to use a modicum of common sense. A lot of the arguments we'll talk about today will strengthen otherwise strong arguments. And perhaps if you have an argument that's kind of on the fence, you know, where the case could go either way, perhaps some of what we're going to talk about today will be the thing that tips the scale. But you don't want to open up the mail and get an order that says something like this hapless fellow. It says, a review of the complaint reveals that plaintiff is attempting to bring this action under the Declaration of Independence and the Northwest Ordinance. However, neither provides plaintiff with a cognizable basis for his suit. So you don't just want to walk into court and say, Judge, the Declaration of Independence says that I should win, because that's probably not going to do you too well. But to the extent that these give a historical background on what the current law is, I think sometimes they can strengthen, like I say, an otherwise strong case, or maybe be the thing that tips the scale. Well, as I mentioned, moving on to the formation of Minnesota Territory. Again, the portion of the state east of the Mississippi, not where we're sitting today. And incidentally, we are sitting today in Rochester. And for our podcast viewers, I'm going to have three code words. And the first code word is Rochester. R-O-C-H-E-S-T-E-R is our first code word. Well, where we're sitting today in Rochester is west of the Mississippi. So that immediately prior to statehood, or immediately prior to territoryhood, I should say, this was actually Iowa Territory, because Iowa Territory included the current boundaries of the state of Iowa, and then continuing north to Minnesota, west of what is now Minnesota, west of the Mississippi, extending pretty much basically to the Missouri River. So it included the western half of Minnesota and kind of the eastern half of the Dakotas, although they weren't really explored very much at that time. Immediately prior to Minnesota becoming a territory, the portion east of the Mississippi, so St. Paul and Stillwater, which were the main communities there at the time, they were part of Wisconsin Territory. Well, prior to Minnesota coming into the Union, it was the typical practice had been is that, like I say, when each new state was admitted to the Union, the remaining territory, which they sometimes called the rump territory, was broken off, given a new name, and it became a territory. So, for example, the original Northwest Territory was the current state of Ohio, extending all the way to the Mississippi River. So that included the current states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. I don't think I left any off. So when Ohio joined the Union as a state in the early 1800s, the Northwest Territory ceased to exist as of that date. And the remaining territory, including the eastern half of Minnesota, became part of Indiana Territory. And then a few years later, Indiana was admitted to the Union. And so the state of Indiana was created, and a new entity was for the remaining territory, Illinois Territory, was broken off. That process continued. When Illinois entered the Union, the remaining territory became Michigan Territory. When Michigan joined the Union, that remaining territory became Wisconsin Territory. And in each of those cases, when the new state or when the new territory was created, there was an explicit provision in the Organic Act. Again, an Organic Act is the statute that creates a new territory. In all those cases, there was an explicit provision saying that the laws of the predecessor territory would remain in effect, except to the extent that they were changed. So, for example, when Ohio joined the Union, Indiana Territory was created, and the Indiana Organic Act says, unless modified, the prior laws of the Northwest Territory remain in effect. And when Indiana joined the Union and Illinois Territory was created, the provision was that the new laws in the Illinois Territory would be the old law in Indiana Territory. And that process continued on, and it gives kind of a chain of title, if you will, to the law in each of those new territories and new states. Because, just again, hypothetically, don't run into court and make this argument, but for example, in 1788, the territorial legislature of the Northwest Territory passed some statute that said something. And that statute was never repealed, and there was never any other statute that took the place of that. Well, then in theory, that 1788 territorial law of Northwest Territory became the law of Indiana Territory, and then that became part of the law of Illinois Territory, and then it became part of the law of Michigan Territory, and then it became part of the law of Wisconsin Territory. So again, there's kind of that that chain of title there. And a little bit later in the material, there's a law review article that discusses that in a little bit more detail. So that means in theory, and again, it's been a couple hundred years, so chances are there has been a new enactment that covers that particular subject. But again, because of that chain of title, if you're looking at what current Minnesota law is on perhaps some arcane subject, you have to kind of follow that chain of title back into time. Now, in most cases, that's not necessarily of a lot of practical application when it comes to statutes, because each of those territories did adopt a pretty comprehensive code of statutes, and most of those were probably pretty similar. So, I mean, it's very unlikely that situation is going to come up in practice. But it's just kind of good to keep in mind, just to kind of give you a conceptual view of what's going on, that if you're researching something, if you have to go back a little bit further in time, there are these other sources out there in which you can go further back in time. So that was the practice up through Wisconsin Territory. Now, again, Minnesota joined the Union in 18, or excuse me, Iowa joined the Union in 1846, and Wisconsin came into the Union in 1848. And Iowa, we're not going to talk quite as much about, but of course that followed a similar process. It started out as the Louisiana Territory, and then as new states joined the Union, pieces were cut off, and the last piece was Iowa Territory. Well, when Iowa joined the Union in 1846, and Wisconsin came into the Union in 1848, when that happened, there was no provision made for the remaining territory, unlike what had been done over the years. And there's a little bit of an argument amongst historians about the exact significance of that. And one of the leading historians is of the state. If you ever went to the University of Minnesota, you're on the West Bank, you probably took classes in Blagan Hall. Well, Blagan, Theodore Christian Blagan, was kind of one of the leading historians of the state. And he just kind of says matter-of-factly, well, when Iowa joined the Union, I guess the government ceased to exist up here. Well, I think that's Blagan was a historian, he wasn't a lawyer, and I think that's not really fair to say that the law totally ceased to exist up here, because there were even land titles east of the Mississippi. There were actually government officers of the former St. Croix Territory, or that is of the St. Croix Territory, St. Croix County of the former Wisconsin Territory, and that. You know, some of those officials, you know, justices of the peace, and some people purporting to have a government office based upon Wisconsin territorial law, they did continue to function. So I don't think it's fair to say, like Blagan does, that the law simply ceased to exist up here and that there was no territorial organization. But that an argument could be made that Wisconsin territory ceased to exist the day that Wisconsin joined the Union. Therefore, Minnesota, at least that part east of the Mississippi, kind of lapsed into no government. I don't think that's a very good argument because again, the Northwest Territories or the Northwest Ordinance purports to speak in perpetuity about the rights that are granted, but that argument did come up, and something had to be done about it. You know, the status of this country had to be clarified. And that's kind of an interesting chapter in Minnesota history of what happened. Shortly after Wisconsin joined the Union in May of 1848, there were some preliminary meetings both in St. Paul and Stillwater, which were the leading settlements. The other one was actually Mendota, where Henry Sibley was from, and we'll get to him in a minute. But there were a series of meetings amongst some of the inhabitants trying to figure out what to do, how to deal with this situation of having the territorial government arguably lapsed. And so what they did is they called a convention for August 26th of 1848, kind of a not. They didn't really purport to have it be an official constitutional convention or anything like that. It was more of just a public meeting to decide what to do and to elect some kind of representative to go to Washington and plead for the case for the creation of a new territorial structure in Minnesota. So that meeting was held in August of 1848. And Henry Sibley, the fur trader who had been here since, I think, the 1830s, up near Mendota, he was elected by that body to be a delegate to go to Washington and to present a memorial to the Congress and to the President calling for a creation of a new Minnesota territory. And the name Minnesota was used at that meeting, quite possibly because Sibley was down at Mendota on the Minnesota River, where it came together with the Mississippi. So they made this memorial to and sent Sibley to Washington to go plead the case to Washington. Well, again, I think a pretty good argument can be made that the some kind of territorial structure continued to exist. So somebody came up with the idea, well, rather than just sending Sibley there as an unofficial delegate just to be a lobbyist and to go plead the case, the law creating Wisconsin territory has never been repealed. You know, Wisconsin state joined the Union, but Wisconsin territory, the law creating that, has never been repealed. So the argument was made, well, why don't we just, we'll operate on the assumption that the territory still exists, and we are entitled to a territorial delegate to Congress. And even today, the states, of course, have representation in both the Senate and the Congress. Territories have representation in the form of a delegate who's deemed to be a member of Congress, the House of Representatives. He's allowed to speak on the floor, and he's entitled to all of the other benefits of being a member of Congress, with the exception of having a vote. That same system was in effect then. So the argument was made was, well, why don't we send a delegate to Washington as the delegate of Wisconsin territory, because that has never been uncreated after it was originally created. So the argument was we should still have this representation in Congress. Well, nobody knows who came up with that idea. It was a pretty good idea, but somebody prevailed upon the former secretary, or the secretary of the Wisconsin Territory, they would say. They wouldn't have said former. The secretary of a territory was kind of like the lieutenant governor. I think there were just two executive offices, the governor of the territory and the secretary. And the secretary was kind of the second in command. And there were typically three judges appointed as part of the territorial government also. But somebody prevailed upon John Catlin, who had been secretary of the Wisconsin territorial government. The governor of Wisconsin territory had been Henry Dodge. And upon election, or upon admission to the Union, Dodge had been elected senator of the new state. So it was assumed that he had given up the office of governor upon his election as senator. So the secretary of the territory, John Catlin, he ruled that the office of governor had lapsed and that he had become the acting governor of Wisconsin Territory. And he, of course, was sitting in Madison, so he traveled to Stillwater, which was the boundary of what had not been admitted to the Union. The boundaries of Wisconsin were as they are presently, the Mississippi and then the St. Croix River. So Catlin traveled to Stillwater, and he called for an election to elect the new delegate from the Wisconsin Territory. And he called for this election to take place on October 30th. And that election was held. Interestingly, it was kind of to Sibley's surprise, because after the Stillwater Convention, everybody assumed that Sibley was willing and able to travel to Washington to make this argument. Another fur trader came along, Henry Rice, who would was a fur trader with a competing company, and he was based a little bit further to the northwest. He decided to run as well, and of course, both of those names kind of continue into Minnesota history. But anyway, that election was held. The interesting footnote of that was one thing you'll learn about this is, when you see something today in the news that just seems very strange, chances are it's happened before. And you'll see a few examples of that here. This one, we have contentious elections today. Well, they had contentious elections back then. And back then, the contentious issue in this election was whether the French should be allowed to vote. And when they said French, what they were really referring to were the Métis, the French and Indians, the half-breed, if you will, residents of the state. During the years of the fur trade, there were quite a few people who were half French and half Native American. So the issue in this case was whether those people who were called the French were to be entitled to the vote. Sibley lodged a protest with the county board of the St. Croix Territorial County, and they kind of said, well, it's not ripe yet, let's just wait till after the election's over. But what his protest was that the French were given the vote a little bit too liberally, and that perhaps they shouldn't have been. The precinct where Rice prevailed with his French vote was, I believe, Rum River, so kind of way out on the frontier, like near Anoka, kind of northwest of where most of the action was going on. Just kind of an interesting side note, kind of the compromise that they came up with in that case was that the French would be entitled to vote if they had adopted the white man's ways. And you know, you talk about election problems today, voter ID, well, that's kind of a fluid standard of, you know, somebody walks into the polling station and you have to decide if they've adopted the white man's ways. Well, the kind of the acid test on that was, is the prospective voter wearing trousers? So the persons coming into the polling station wearing trousers were given the vote. And it was rumored that in some villages there was a single pair of trousers that was passed amongst all the voters to entitle them to vote. But despite the support of the French in the Northwest, Sibley went on to make that to win that election, and he traveled to Washington to represent the interests of the new state. And he was seated as a delegate of the Wisconsin Territory. So if you look back at the roll call of members of the Congress in 1848, you'll see one representative from the state of Wisconsin, and you will also see at the same time the delegate from Wisconsin Territory. And as far as I know, that's the only time that's happened. But when he did get to Washington, it was a bit of a contentious issue, and he had to fight for the seat a little bit. And he made this speech that I have quoted here in the materials, and he gets a little bit melodramatic, because you can see he's referring to the gentleman from North Carolina, because, you know, again, this was 1848, so it's only about 13 years before the Civil War. So, you know, slavery was clearly a big issue, and the honorable gentleman from North Carolina is probably not interested in making it too much easier to have another free state in the Northwest come in. So Sibley was not immediately seated, but this was the matter was sent to the Committee on Credentials, or whatever it was called. He made this speech there, and arguing a little bit melodramatically, saying, well, what, you know, if either we have a government up there or we have no government at all, and part of the government that we do have is the representation in Congress. So he's saying, well, what, you know, what would happen if we had no government at all? So he says, well, some malefactor has been apprehended. If some fugitive came from another state up to the Minnesota country, it would become a haven for fugitives because it would be a country with no law. So he made that argument. He did it well, and he was seated as territorial delegate. It, kind of an interesting side note, as you noticed, the election took place on October 30th, which is getting kind of late in the year, and the main polling, the main economic activity back then was Mendota, where he was from, and St. Paul and Stillwater. But by October 30th of the year, it's getting pretty late in the season. And until that time, the railroad had not come out here yet. The connection that this part of the country had with the outside world was the steamboats that went up and down the Mississippi. So by October 30th, it was too late in the season and there were no steamboats. So he actually had a rather arduous journey that he had to make in order to get to Washington. And the speech was made on December 22nd, so within that 2 months he made it to Washington. But he had to take a sled, I think, as far as Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and I think the railroad went that far. But otherwise, he was, this country was kind of incommunicado for a big part of the year. Incidentally, in the territorial days, what the main connection to the outside world was the steamboats on the Mississippi. One of them in particular, you'll see the name of quite often, is a boat called the Dr. Franklin. And they went to St. Paul and Mendota. And the kind of the outposts of civilization that they went to were Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and Galena, Illinois. So for news to travel from Washington or anywhere out east, it had to first go through Galena or Prairie du Chien and then up the Mississippi on boat, whenever the boats came. Which brings us to our second word, Galena. G-A-L-E-N-A, a town in Illinois or a mineral. Galena is our second code word. Well, anyway, Sibley went to Washington. He made that speech to the Committee on Elections, it was called. He won his seat, and on March 3rd, Minnesota Territory was created. And again, that took place on March 3rd. It was some time later that word actually got back here that had been granted. But it came on the Dr. Franklin. One kind of historical curiosity is that they did overlook Sibley was from Mendota, which was at the time called St. Peter's. But he was at Mendota, and he was actually on the west side of the Mississippi. So he actually was a resident of Iowa Territory. An argument could be made that the Wisconsin Territory still existed, but you can't really make an argument that he was a resident. I'm not going to cover it. Is that Organic Act of 1849 that created Minnesota Territory, that act, like all those predecessor acts, says that to the extent that it's not changed, Wisconsin territorial law will continue in effect in Minnesota. And it does not make a distinction of which side of the Mississippi you're on. So here in Olmsted County, even though we're on the west side of the Mississippi, the Wisconsin territorial law would have still governed this area. So again, we have a chain of title of the law in the state. If Minnesota state law is silent on a subject, but there was something in territorial law that covered that subject matter, then that territorial law would remain in effect. But again, you can take that back even further. So to the Wisconsin territorial laws. So, for example, that probably doesn't apply too much for statutes because, like I said, the codes that were adopted by the territorial legislatures were pretty comprehensive and also probably, to a large extent, copied from the earlier one anyway. So it really doesn't make a difference. But where that might come in is looking at court precedents. So for example, volume one of Minnesota reports covers the territorial years. And that's, those are as much Minnesota Supreme Court cases as Volume 2, which covers the state Supreme Court. I mean, that's like the predecessor court. The Minnesota Territorial Supreme Court was the predecessor court of the Minnesota State Supreme Court. Well, you can also make the argument, though, that the Wisconsin Territorial cases are also, the Wisconsin Territorial Supreme Court was also a predecessor court of the Minnesota Supreme Court. So an early Wisconsin territorial case is, in theory, not simply persuasive precedent, as a later Wisconsin case would be, but you can make the argument that that's really a predecessor court. Therefore, that is really a binding authority. And again, you can trace that back even further. So the same would also be true of Michigan territorial Supreme Court decisions, or Illinois, or Indiana, or Northwest Territory. So that's something to keep in mind. You know, like I say, it's not your case, you're not going to win or lose a case on that, but like I say, I think it can kind of strengthen an otherwise strong argument. If your 1840 case is from the Wisconsin Territorial Supreme Court, and the other guy's 1840 case is from the North Carolina Supreme Court, well, you should win, because your 1840 case is a binding precedent, and the other guy's is merely persuasive. So that's something to keep in mind. Well, the Minnesota Territory was created in 1849, and Minnesota became a state in 1858. So, well, I'll jump back to the territorial time in a little bit, but for now we will jump ahead to the Minnesota Constitution. And again, the statehood procedure under the Northwest Ordinance, which kind of continues today. So if the Virgin Islands ever became a state, kind of the same procedure would probably apply. And what that is first of all, a territory is created. And that happened in Minnesota in 1849. Then, when the population reaches a sufficient level to consider making a state, the U.S. Congress passes an Enabling Act. And that Enabling Act states that the inhabitants of that territory can call a constitutional convention, and it directs them to prepare a state constitution. And then after the state constitutional convention adopts that constitution, that is sent back to the federal Congress for approval. And if the U.S. Congress approves the constitution, then at that time the state becomes a state. So I mean, most recently Alaska and Hawaii, you know, the Alaska Territory had existed, and then sometime in, you know, about 58 or 59, an Enabling Act was passed saying that the residents of Alaska should adopt a constitution. They call a constitutional convention, adopt it, and then at such time as that constitution is approved by Congress, it becomes a state. Well, Minnesota is unique in that regard. And again, talking about history repeating itself, you think of politics today as very confrontational, and you think of this earlier golden age when everybody was civilized. Well, it wasn't quite so civilized back in the golden age either. Because first of all, the election for delegates to the Constitutional Convention. You know, if you're going to run for Constitutional Convention, you'd like to think that you're going to campaign based upon these lofty ideals, and, you know, you're going to talk about human rights and all this stuff. Well, that's not what happened during the election. It was very much parochial interests that went into the elections for these individual delegates in their individual areas. So it was the fur traders versus the farmers, and versus, you know, everybody had their own little parochial interest, and that's how the campaigns were run. But the delegates were elected, and they all came to St. Paul for the convention to adopt the state constitution. Well, Minnesota is unique in the Union in that we have two state constitutions. We have the Republican version and we have the Democratic version. And they are both similar, but not quite identical. And the how that came to be was they came to St. Paul, very contentious thing going on. They didn't have they didn't have a public address system. Well, there were two people up there purporting to chair the meeting in this crowded chamber. There was a Republican up there and there was a Democrat, they were both purporting to chair the meeting. The Democratic chairman took a motion. He heard a motion that they adjourn for the rest of the day. They voted on it. In his opinion, that motion passed. So he ruled that the convention was adjourned for the day, and they left the chamber, and they were going to come back the next day and get back to work. However, there was another chairman standing up there, the Republican, he just simply proceeded with the business of the meeting. And I guess after all the Democrats left, it was probably less crowded and probably a little bit more orderly, and they got a lot of work done. Well, the Democrats came back the next day, and I guess the Republicans got up earlier, and they were already in the chamber. So the Democrats got there for the convention, and they noticed that the room was already in use. So they just walked down the hall to the other chamber, and they continued their convention down there. So during the entire course of the Constitutional Convention, there were two separate conventions going on, each of which claimed that it was the Constitutional Convention. They continued to meet. There are proceedings for both of those that were published, and they're in the library. Those proceedings, they both had separate volumes. So if you go to the library, you'll find the proceedings of the Democratic version of the convention and the proceedings of the Republican version. Somehow, it's really not documented how this happened. That doesn't seem like a good situation, but they did manage to produce documents that were substantially the same. Probably wasn't just chance. There probably was some kind of conference committee of cooler heads that prevailed, that met after the main sessions. Because each of those conventions produced a constitution that was substantially identical to the other one. So nobody quite knows exactly how that happened, but they did manage to pull it off. But while they are almost identical, they are not quite identical. There are minor little differences here and there. Little things, like the placement of a comma or the spelling of a word or something. But there are these two, if you ever have to refer to the original Constitution, you have to be aware that there are two original constitutions, the Republican version and the Democratic version, and they are not quite identical. They are very similar. So, if you ever have to, if the meaning of some provision comes down to the placement of a comma, and this means this because it's clear because they put this comma here. Well, you better, if you're going to make that argument, you better go double check and make sure that comma exists in both places, because both of those have equal standing. And whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you have to give equal standing to both of them, because just to kind of guarantee that, I believe one was printed on white paper and one was printed on blue tinted paper. And the reason why you have to definitely consult both of them is when the original document was sent to Washington, I forget which one it was. It was either the Republican or the Democratic version. One version was sent to Washington for Congress to give its seal of approval. And Congress did vote to ratify that and put it into effect. But when it was transmitted back to the state, it was transmitted along with the other copy. So one of these two competing sides managed to managed to get their version sent to Washington, but somehow the other side managed to get their version sent back. So there's really no escaping it that they are on equal footing. Now, if you ever looked at Volume 1 of Minnesota Statutes Annotated, if you look in there, you will find a copy of these two handwritten documents appearing at the front of it. It was typeset somewhere along the way, but because of, there are those minor differences, you really have to look at those original two handwritten documents when you really need to get down to parsing the meaning of the sentence. Well, I'm sure one of you is about to ask, well, what about the amended Constitution of 1974? Surely that settles everything. If you were about to ask that, that's a good observation, because the Minnesota Constitution was readopted in 1974. State constitutions get kind of messy because you have something in there about the lottery, and you have something in there about the stadium tax, and something in there about the gas tax, and every 2 years something gets amended. So after 100 years, the document gets a little bit messy because they repealed this section about the railroads and added in something about the stadium tax or whatever. So in 1974, I think the revisor's office did the bulk of the work of rewriting the Constitution and putting it into better form. And at that point, some of the section numbering changed. And they cleaned up this document. However, you still have to look at the 1858 Constitution, because the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that that was just a revision and restructuring, and it was not intended to change any long-standing constitutional interpretation. And even if there were inadvertent changes made in 1974, if the revisor's office took out that comma, if they made some inadvertent change, you still have to look to the meaning of the original 1858 document. And when we say the original document, we really mean the original documents, those two versions. So for a long time to come, we'll still have to occasionally consult those handwritten documents in the first volume of Minnesota Reports, or in the first volume of Minnesota Statutes. So again, if you're get down to one of those things where the meaning of this comma or the placement of this word is critical, it does behoove you to look at those two original documents. Well, as I move on now to some of the stuff that's merely interesting. Some of that might be useful, because it does show this lineage or this chain of title for Minnesota law back to these predecessor courts. Won't come up every day, but might come up occasionally. Well, now we're going to talk about some stuff that probably won't ever come up again. But I think it's just kind of interesting to, if you're ever in the library and you're bored, it's kind of interesting to pull down Volume 1 of Minnesota Reports. Because Volume 1 is the volume that covers the territorial period. Volume 2, page 1, whatever that is a Minnesota State Supreme Court case. But the 9 years of jurisprudence is in a volume about that thick, covering the territorial years. And it's kind of an interesting one to look through. And especially when you kind of flip through it, you start at the front, and by the time you get to the back, you've moved 9 years through history. Some of the cases are pretty boring. I certainly wouldn't suggest anybody read every single word in that book. But it's kind of interesting to see how the cases progress from a very frontier existence at the beginning of that book to a rather prosperous territory by the end. And you can see that there's a lot of economic expansion. One that's simply kind of interesting, I think, is this case, the Dr. Franklin. And now, you probably won't cite that case too often. It unless, of course, if your client has some logs in the river and somebody else's steamboat comes and crashes into them, that's the case you need, because that case holds that the owner of the steamboat has to pay $150 for the damage to those logs. But that's kind of interesting in that that the boat mentioned in that case, the Dr. Franklin, that was the boat that went up and down the Mississippi and was kind of the lifeline for commerce. It comes up everywhere in Minnesota history. Again, even in this golden age when that valuable lifeline was not immune from suit. And in fact, when in Brian's presentation, it's kind of interesting, he's going to be talking about whiplash and the history of that. Some of those early cases are about the railroad. You know, the railroad was certainly very critical coming out here, but when that train injured somebody, the plaintiff's lawyers were out here a long time ago. It's kind of interesting, we just look at this opinion by Judge Fuller, who I'll talk about in a second. You can tell, early in the frontier, there wasn't a very big law library out here, so he kind of talks in this opinion about the practical considerations of, you know, when you're going to cite some authority to the trial judge, you can't expect him to know everything, but you have to, you have to be able to cite to exactly the point that you have. So you can't just make a broad objection, especially if you're out in the frontier where the judge probably only has a couple of law books with him as he rides the circuit. You have to be somewhat specific in your legal arguments. If you read that, it looks like this guy is probably a pretty good judge, Justice Fuller. But it's interesting that Justice Fuller, one of the first justices of the Minnesota Territorial Supreme Court, he was appointed by the president, and after his appointment, he set off for the frontier. But that appointment, like any presidential appointment, has to be confirmed by the Senate. Well, he was never confirmed by the Senate, but he had already gone out here to Minnesota, and he was already presiding over cases and writing opinions that made it into the law books. So it's a certain, again, this delay in, because we're way out at the end of the supply line here as far as communications. So it took some time for the word to get out here that he had not been appointed. So when word got out here that he had not been appointed, he packed his bags and went home, but not after deciding many cases. And apparently he went back to New York and became a county judge. Like I say, looking at this opinion, though, it looks like he was probably a pretty good judge. Seemed to have quite a bit of common sense, even if the Senate didn't disagree. Just talking a little bit about the judiciary back in the territorial days. As I mentioned, there were basically five federal officials that were appointed. Well, in fact, Fuller made the argument that he was federal. That's how he tried to get a little bit more credence for his side. But really, they were federal officials because the territorial government was appointed by the President of the United States. And that government consisted of the governor, and the first governor of Minnesota Territory was Alexander Ramsey. So he was appointed by the president. There was a secretary who was like the combination lieutenant governor, secretary of state, second in line if the office of governor lapsed. That was the executive branch of the government. The judicial branch consisted of three judges, and they were justices of the Supreme Court, and they also heard trials. So they rode the circuit, and each one was assigned to a different county. And I think the three seats of the trial court at the time were Stillwater and St. Paul, and I believe initially Mendota. So those three judges were assigned to trial duties in one of those three locations. And then in addition to that, they served as the appellate court. And the rules of procedure were such that pretty much any time two of those judges were in the same place, that constituted a meeting of the Supreme Court. So, for example, if a decision by one of those judges could be affirmed by that judge and one other judge. If you only have three judges, there was not a requirement that that they recuse themselves. So that constituted the judicial branch of the government. And then, of course, the legislative branch of the government was territorial legislature, which was elected. But Fuller was one of these three judges, and he was not confirmed, so he left the Minnesota scene. Again, as I mentioned, it's kind of interesting to look at that first volume just to kind of see how the economic activity progressed over those 9 years that, that Minnesota was a territory, because you can definitely see a difference in character from the first one to the last one, because it was a pretty wild, desolate area out here at the beginning, but by the end you can see there was a lot of commerce beginning to grow. One interesting thing, I don't know if you've ever noticed that when you look at those old cases, the citation looks kind of funny, because it'll, like this first case, it's 1 Minnesota 73 Gill 51, with Gill in parentheses. There were two editions of those early volumes of Minnesota Reports published. One was called the Gill Felon Edition, and one was called the Officer Edition. And in some states, in those early reporters, the volume numbers tend to change. But in Minnesota, those two kind of competing reporters have the same volume numbers, but the page numbers are different. So in this example, I gave you 1 Min 73 Gill 51. That means if you pick up your Minnesota Reports, the case will either be on page 51 or 73, depending on whether it's the Gill Felon Edition, which was edited by Judge Gill Felon, one of the, in addition to the reporter of those cases, he was Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. So that would be the Gill Felon Edition. The other one is the Officer Edition. And for many years, I always assumed that it was like for officers of the court or something like that. Well, no, it turns out the editor of that volume was a Mr. Officer. So it's the Officer's Edition Mr. Officer would have put it on a different page from Mr. Gilfillan. But anyway, if you look at the, I just kind of did a breakdown here, not too scientific. I just looked at the 81 cases that are in that book and talked, kind of looked to see what the subject matter of those decisions were. You can see the commercial law and contract law, the law related to commerce was kind of the leading subject, kind of followed by appellate procedure and civil procedure and executions. So it's very down to earth kinds of things that are talking about, just the civil procedure and the law of contracts and negotiable instruments. Those issues were a lot being decided there. So, again, this when you look at this volume one, it's kind of an interesting historical curiosity, just to kind of look through and see what these cases are about and the kinds of things that were going on. Because, one good way to see what people are doing is to see who they're suing. That's a pretty good picture of what's going on historically. But most of that, I think it's pretty safe to say, is just a historical curiosity. You won't cite those very often. However, there is one important exception to that, and of how the territorial law of Minnesota is kind of locked in as of the date of the Constitution, and that is in the area of the right to trial by jury. Because like, you know, most, the Minnesota Constitution, like most state constitutions, begins with a Bill of Rights. Part of that Bill of Rights says that people are entitled to right to trial by jury. Well, now, the way that's worded though, now some states are a little bit more explicit than Minnesota. And for example, I quote the Illinois Constitution, and it, like most states, says that the right to trial by jury as heretofore enjoyed shall remain inviolate. So it says the right to trial by jury is kind of defined as what it was as heretofore. And heretofore means prior to the adoption of the Constitution. So in this case of the Illinois Constitution, that's pretty clear, that the right to trial by jury shall continue to exist as it existed immediately prior to the Constitution. And immediately prior to the Constitution was the territorial law. Now, Minnesota does not use language quite that explicit, but it has still been interpreted that way. But it's still pretty explicit, because the Minnesota Constitution says that the right of trial by jury shall remain inviolate. So it doesn't specify anything in the Constitution of what the right to trial by jury is. Does it say you get 6 people? Does it say you get 12 people? Does it say, you know, what kind of cases juries decide and what kind of courts the judge decide? No, it doesn't have any specifics at all. It simply says that the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate. Well, even though it's not quite as clear as some of these other state constitutions, that has been interpreted to mean that it shall remain as it existed prior to the adoption of the Constitution. And prior to the adoption of the Constitution, kind of by definition, means under territorial law. So therefore, anything in Volume 1 that gives anybody the right to trial by jury, anything in Volume 1 of Minnesota Reports, that's kind of locked in by the Constitution, because that one volume covers the territorial Supreme Court cases. And also any territorial statute regarding the right to trial by jury is more or less locked in by this provision of the Constitution. Now, the Constitution has been amended, of course. So for example, 6 person juries in misdemeanor cases. In the absence of any other provision to the contrary, it is pretty clear, and I have some of the cases cited here, that when looking to the what it means to have the right to trial by jury, that means you need to look at the law as it existed under the territorial law of Minnesota. And as we discovered before, if you don't know what the law was, if it was unclear under the territorial law, you can also look back at those predecessor territories. Because each time a new territory was created, it adopted explicitly the pre-existing law of the earlier territory. So, if it's not in Volume 1 of Minnesota Reports, then you look in the early territorial decisions of Wisconsin Supreme Court and Michigan and Illinois and Indiana and the Northwest Territory. And those shall remain inviolate, or as some states say, as heretofore. And incidentally, on this page, I left off one word, because I said, in the paragraph starts so obviously, it says, and arguably, the last sentence, the same can be said for the territorial laws of Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and the Northwest Territory. I just left off Michigan. That would be part of that chain of title as well. So laws affecting right to trial by jury, you could probably make the argument in some cases that you could take that a little bit more broadly than, you know, just it, you know, is this person entitled to a jury trial? For example, on a summary judgment case, well, summary judgment, what you're doing is you're taking the case away from the jury. So, and the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate as it was prior to 1858. So, I mean, you can make the argument, and I would not make this as my only argument, but I mean, I think you can make the argument that that kind of locked in summary judgment as it existed back then. And of course, I mean, there was summary judgment in the territorial courts, so I mean, you can't just say that summary judgment is unconstitutional. But if the law about summary judgment changed substantially over the years from how it existed back in the 1840s, you could probably make an argument that that violates the right to trial by jury provision of the Minnesota Constitution. There's not a lot said about jurors in that volume one, but the subject is addressed. For example, the St. Martin case states that juror affidavits are not competent to impeach a verdict. And now that's pretty well settled for, probably it's pretty well settled 100 years before that. You can't go into court and have a juror testify that the verdict was improper. That's just not admissible testimony. So I mean, that's pretty well settled. But you know, if that rule were to ever change, you know, if jurors could impeach their own verdict, well, I would argue that that change would be improper because that affects the right to jury trial as it existed in 1848 or in 1858. Another interesting case. I don't know if we get too much out of it as far as black letter law these days, but it was the Steele v. Maloney case, and that also talked about jurors. That's interesting in that they ran out of jurors. They needed 12 jurors for this case. They ran out. They hadn't summoned enough jurors. So the judge just sent the sheriff out and said, "Go find me some jurors." So the sheriff went out into the street. Now it's not written in the case, but he probably went to a bar. Where do you find people other than in a tavern? So the sheriff went down to the local bar and summoned the people he found there to come down to the courthouse and serve as jurors. So anyway, the Supreme Court said that was appropriate, especially out on the frontier where you might not have enough people otherwise, and you have to go round them up. So it's a little bit of an irregular practice, but it was called for by the statute. That procedure was actually in the statute, and I think it still is today. That the sheriff can, if the sheriff walked in the door right now and said we're all going to go serve on the jury, we would have to go. So they upheld that procedure. Steele was also interesting, again, kind of going into the impeaching a verdict after the fact. Apparently one of these people that got rounded up had not lived in the territory long enough to serve as a juror. I don't know how long you have to live in the state to be on a jury, probably 30 days or 60 days or something. Some of the jurors had not served for the requisite time. They just showed up that day and got put on a jury. Well, the holding of the Supreme Court was that, well, you have to make a contemporaneous objection. You can't come in, you can object to that juror because he hasn't lived there long enough, but you can't wait till the trial is over. You have to make a contemporaneous objection. The right to trial by jury is not discussed a great deal, but the topic does come up in there, and it undoubtedly comes up in other cases in those predecessor territorial courts, and it undoubtedly comes up in the territorial statutes. So if you do have a case talking about the right to trial by jury, you have to kind of dig in a little bit more to find the case law, because it's very explicit that those 1840s cases are binding precedent. They're not just, it's not just a good idea, but those were specifically adopted by the Supreme Court. Well, we have about 15 minutes left. I just have some kind of historical vignettes. That's kind of the bulk of the presentation. But I'll just talk a little bit about some of these biographies, and if you have any questions, please feel free to ask. If you look through these names of the early judges of the Supreme Court, you know, some of them will look familiar, and some of them do not look familiar. Well, the reason why some of them look familiar is because, you know, some of these guys got a county or a city named after them. And they were typically the ones that stuck around. Well, you know, there's no Fuller County. We already talked about poor Judge Fuller, who was not adopted by the, or was not ratified by the Senate. He had to go back east. So typically, I have links to some of the biographies here if you're interested in looking at them later, but some of these names you don't see anymore, and that's because they just couldn't take the mosquitoes out here or something, and after their term of office, they went back east. But some of them, as you can see, you know, there's a Meeker County, there's a Sherburne County, you know, so you can kind of tell even without looking at the biographies of who stayed and who went back home, and often to become judges in back in their home state after this adventure out on the frontier. Some of the other figures talk about, you know, some of those names come up here again. Kind of one of the most interesting names in Minnesota history is Henry Sibley, Henry Hastings Sibley. He came out here, he was actually the son of, I believe his father's name was Solomon Sibley. And Solomon Sibley was the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court. So young Henry Hastings Sibley came out here as a fur trader. I don't remember the year, but it was probably in the 1830s. Or maybe 1840s, but he set up out here as a fur trader, and what was then just the remotest corner of Michigan territory, still at that time. And his father was actually the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court. So you think of fur traders as being kind of these gruff, rustic characters. But Sibley was actually very educated. He was, again, that speech he gave on the floor of Congress, he was a very good lawyer. He made an argument well, and he was a very refined person. He was a fur trader in Mendota, and that's an interesting site if you ever get up there to Mendota, the Sibley historical site. It's a recreation of his fur post there. One of the interesting historical sites in the state. But in addition to this fur trader on the Pioneer, he was a lawyer and a merchant, and a very educated person. He went on, after being the territorial delegate, he went on to become after being the territorial delegate from Wisconsin, as we discussed before, he went on to become the territorial delegate for Minnesota, and he was elected the first governor of the state. He came out here at the age of 18, so he came out here as a young man, but already pretty learned in the law. Another name that you see, and again, I have links to a lot of these in the written materials, so if you're curious about any of the names that come up in Minnesota history, you can take a look at those. One that again, you see quite often because of those Gilfillan reports is Judge Gilfillan. And he served as, he was appointed to the Minnesota Supreme Court. He actually lost his first election, but then he went on to become reelected and was later became the chief justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court for many years. And in addition to that, he wrote those early volumes of Minnesota reports. Governor Ramsey, Alexander Ramsey, he was the first territorial governor of Minnesota. And he was a political rival, but close personal friend of Sibley. And I think, I strongly suspect that rambunctious convention, it's really not documented anywhere, but I suspect it's Sibley and Ramsey were the ones who were the calm our heads that prevailed and had conference committees so that they had at least came up with two documents that were pretty similar rather than having two completely different documents. Because Sibley was a Democrat, Ramsey was originally a Whig. Then with the collapse of the Whig Party, he was a Republican. So they were political rivals over the years, but close personal friends. In fact, when Ramsey first came up here after being appointed by the president to serve as governor of Minnesota Territory, which was very little. Very little out here. It was Sibley that welcomed him. We went to Mendota on the steamboat, and then they went by canoe to St. Paul, where he dropped off the new governor to serve. One of the first judges was one Aaron Goodrich, and the link there is to an article from Minnesota History, and if you want the a colorful character in Minnesota jurisprudence. He's a colorful character. I don't know how well you can see it here, but there's a portrait of him. He looks like a rather gruff character, and he was maybe he was a good judge, but he kind of had his personal eccentricities. One visitor. Visiting in the 1860s, not knowing who it was reporting about this person they saw, and they said they saw a strange, comical-looking character carrying his thumbs in the armholes of a not over-clean white waistcoat with a tall black hat perched on the back of his head, perambulating thoughtfully up and down. So that was one of our early judges. So if you're ever before an eccentric judge, there have been eccentric judges in the past. So, kind of an interesting biography if you want to take a look at that. He ran into trouble, among other things. Trying to defend the landlady of his hotel. There was not much up here. There was a hotel built in St. Paul called the American House, and that's where that was pretty much the only place to stay when that was built. Somewhere in the late territorial period, and he thought the manager of this hotel was being treated unfairly, this landlady, and he, as a result of legitimately defending her, he kind of became the subject of rumor and innuendo. So kind of an interesting story. The first meeting of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Actually took place in a log cabin. The first hotel in St. Paul, before that American House was built, was just a crude log structure. So these, if you were appointed, the President of the United States just appointed you to this grand position, and you come out to the middle of nowhere, and all there is this little log shack that you have to. Set up court in. So the first Chief Justice conducted court in his room in this little hotel, in this little rickety bed, and wind blowing in through the chinks in the logs. Again, the organization of the courts back then was there were three judges, and they met the three judges held trial in three different locations. Chief Justice Goodrich was the first one to hold trial in Minnesota, and in addition to in addition to being a judge, he actually had to write the rules of procedure. So his first, the first time he showed up in court in Stillwater, which was probably bigger than St. Paul at the time, one of the accounts was that there were lawyers from every state of the union. So the as commerce moved west, lawyers moved west with it, seeking to make their fortune out here. So there were plenty of lawyers, and his first, let's see, the first day he showed up in court, he rode the circuit out to Stillwater, and he was prepared for trial, and there were something like 20 cases on the calendar. And he got out there, and again, sometimes things don't change very much. He got out there, and they called these 20 cases, and one by one, all the lawyers said that their case was not ready for trial yet. And as you know, things don't change much. If that happened to a judge today, the judge would probably not be pleased, and the judge was not pleased back then. One of the early cases was actually somebody, I can't recall his name, but he went on to become the first county attorney in Ramsey County. Well, he was actually arrested for brandishing a weapon because he was out doing something around St. Croix County, and he was accused of brandishing a weapon, and he wanted to testify that what they saw was not gunpowder that he was putting into his gun. It was crumbs from his lunch or something. But interestingly, back then, he was convicted. So that's the good news. You could be convicted of a crime and still go on to become county attorney. But interestingly, the accused did not have the right to testify in his own defense, because it was assumed that he would lie. So they just, so you did not have the opportunity prior to statehood and well into the 19th century. Criminal defendant did not have the right to say, "Judge, I didn't do it. I was somewhere else." He had to bring in other evidence to that effect. And here it was just him wandering around out in the wilderness with his rifle and the crumbs from his lunch. So he did not have any other witness to say that it was mere crumbs from his lunch. So he was convicted. So it's that kind of seems inconceivable today, because the both the right not to testify and the right to testify seem to be so strongly ingrained into constitutional criminal procedure. But back in the day, that was not the case. The defendant did not have the right to testify. So, well, our time for this first segment is more or less up. I have an extra 1 minute or so for any questions, if you have them.
Was the geographic boundary of the Minnesota Territory, as it was originally set up when Sibley went out to Washington, the same geographic territory?
Yeah, that's a very good question. No, it was not. The Minnesota Territory basically is the current state of Minnesota plus the eastern half of the Dakotas, because the western boundary was the Missouri River. So in fact, that was kind of the key political issue when prior to statehood, or that was one of the issues. When the new state is created, is it going to be vertical, running north to south, as it is currently? Or the other alternative that could have been would that the state of Minnesota would be basically South Dakota and everything east, and leave space for another state to the north. But yes, the original Minnesota Territory did extend as far as the Missouri River.
So when historically did we adopt our western boundary?
At the time of statehood. Yeah, you're right. I should have pointed that out. The what happened in 1858. When statehood, not only does Congress give the right to create a state constitution, but that enabling act also sets the boundaries. So the boundaries are set by Congress, and then the inhabitants of that territory adopt a constitution.
Yeah, good point.
So, well, hearing no more questions, we will, we'll take a short break, and then Brian will take over and tell us about Whiplash.